My name is Yunxin, and I see some people's mind just explode when they try to pronounce my name. Anyway, so a little bit about myself. I just graduated from University of Michigan, and most of this work I'm going to present today is derived from the course project back in school taught by Professor Alex Hondman, who is not here yet. Okay, and then I joined UpThere as a backend engineer. So UpThere is a cloud startup that provides a different model of client-side encryption that allows sharing the encrypted data in a secure context, but that's a different story. So let's start with the example. So I got this spam email from my friend last month. I was kind of debating whether or not I should click into this link. Only one hand I know, it probably was a malicious link and it won't do any good to me. But on the other hand, I was kind of curious about what is inside it. So then I came up with this question: how secure is my browser? I just want to click into that malicious link and see what is inside it. Inside it, I won't do anything else. I won't click anything to avoid click hijacking. I will use the latest version of Chrome, which claims to be safe, and I will enable the incognito mode to avoid the cookie access. So I won't type in any of my sensitive data, and I won't download any of the files from the website. So I just want to click into a link and to see the content of the malicious link. So I wonder if my browser can support that securely. But the answer is no, because DNS rebranding attack is that kind of attack that only needs one click from the user and the user is screwed up. So what is DNS rebranding attack? DNS rebranding attack actually makes the victim's browser to be a proxy. So if we make a proxy into his internal website, we know that we can, as an external attacker, we can gain access to the internal website, such as administrator interface or some web pages that contain sensitive data, like company wiki or code review system, which I will demo later. So, how do we do it? How do we make a victim's browser as a proxy? So, let's start with the naive approach. Now, the naive approach is, hey, it should be easy. So the attacker can host a web page and send the link through whatever method to the victim. And when the victim tries to access it, it sends an HTTP request to the attacker's web server. And the web server can actually reply a JavaScript code that will be running on the victim's browser, which looks like this. So it basically says, please, whoever is going to run the script, please fetch the data from the internal IP address and hand it back to me. So if that can work, when the JavaScript code gets executed on the victim's browser, the browser will actually try to fetch the data from the local IP address, which is his sensitive data behind the firewall, and proxy the response back to the attacker. So that's a problem, right? And people came up with a solution for it, which is called same origin policy. So for those who haven't heard of it, same origin policy basically says the browser will say, hey, this piece of JavaScript code is loaded from, say, attack.com. So it can only interact with attack.com. It cannot interact with google.com. It cannot interact with facebook.com or the internal website. So it actually fixed the issue we mentioned before. But then the attackers came up with a way to get around it. The attacker says, OK, if you fix this issue in the domain name layer, I'm going to attack the IP layer. So there are different variants of this kind of attack, and I'm going to talk about time varying attack today. So the time varying attack is basically for this scenario. So the attacker can register a domain name and provide his own domain name server, which is totally legitimate. So when the victim tries to access attack.com, it first needs to resolve the IP address of attack.com. It goes to the query goes to the domain name server or controlled by the attacker. The attacker can reply the real IP address of the web server of attacker.com, but he will set the time to leave value to zero. So if we have a time to leave value to zero, it means the browser will forget it as soon as it executes this request. So since the victim's browser now knows the IP address of attack.com, you will try to fetch the content from the attacker's web server. Then the attacker's web server actually serves this piece of JavaScript code. It basically says, hey, I am attacker.com, and I honor the same origin policy of the browser. So for any browsers that runs my code, please fetch the data from attack.com, which is legitimate and confirms the same origin policy, and hand the data back to me. So this JavaScript code gets transferred to victim's browser. So when victim's browser runs it, it has already forgot the IP address of attacker's web server. So at this time, since it doesn't know the IP address, it has to issue the second DNS query to the attacker's domain name server. But at this time, the attacker's domain name server will return a malicious DNS entry, which is the internal IP address of the victim. As long as the internal IP address gets back to the victim, the victim's browser will try to fetch the data of attack.com, which is the internal IP address. In this way, the attacker can gain access to the internal data of the victim's internal website. So then people came up with different solutions for it. One of them is called DNS pinning. The DNS pinning basically says, no matter how small the time to leave value is, if a DNS entry is in the browser, please pin it into a browser for a relatively long time, say 1 hour. So the temporary attack can still work, but it actually requires the victim to stay in the malicious web page for 1 hour, which dramatically reduces the successful rate of the DNS rebranding attack. So if we think more about temporary attack, we know the crucial point of that is we need to force the browser to issue a second DNS query so that the malicious DNS server can reply the malicious DNS entry. So how to do that? We have a different solution for it, but before talking about that, let's think more about same origin policy. So if we think more about it, we found that same origin policy actually screws API up. Say you have a little website and it needs to make API calls to Google Maps API. You cannot do that in the JavaScript because the same origin policy, and your website has a different origin than Google Maps API. So how do you do that? Then people came up with different another solutions for it. Say, hey, we can make an exception in these kind of cases. One of them is called JSON padding, and one of them is called WebSocket in HTML5. So those two exceptions are basically protocols. If the server implements the protocols, the server will say, hey, I'm a server. I provide API to my customers and the clients and maybe charge them as much as possible. And so web browsers, I know you are protect me. I know you are trying to protect me from same origin policy, but please don't do that. I know what I'm doing, I'm public, I don't have sensitive data, so please let all the requests pass to me, no matter which origin it comes from. So if you have ever done any web development, you will probably have seen this kind of strange syntax. So this piece of code here basically says, please I'm going to fetch the data from Yahoo's API, and please hand it back to me. So no matter which origin the JavaScript comes from, it can actually run this data and do a cross-site reference to yahoo.com. So, but wait, if we do this query, we have to query yahoo.com, right? If we query yahoo.com for the IP address of it, we need another DNS query for it. So another DNS query means this DNS entry will be pinned into a browser as we discussed before. So, but the browser will have a relatively small amount of DNS entry sizes. So it means we can actually flood the DNS entry and evict the first entries of attack.com. So let's talk about the implementation of our approach. So we have the same situation before. The victim wants to access attack.com, but it needs to query the IP address. And it gets the IP address, and it will try to fetch the data from attack.com. The data served by attack.com contains two parts. The first part is a JavaScript code that will try to flush the DNS table of the browser. The second part is the same as before. So when the request, when the JavaScript code gets transferred to the browser will try to execute the first part of it, which will flush the DNS table by issuing lots of DNS queries, say 1,000 here. So in this big chunk of DNS queries, we're actually the domain name server controlled by attacker will reply lots of DNS entries back to the victim's browser. So the victim's browser got lots of DNS entries. It has nothing to do but only to kick out the first entry of attack.com. So it actually forgets attack.com's IP address at this time. So at this time, when the browser tries to fetch attack.com, it actually forgets the IP address of it, so it has to reissue the DNS query to the domain name server, which gets response a malicious DNS entry. And the rest of the story is the same as before. The browser will try to fetch the data from attack.com, but it actually fetches the data from his internal website. Okay, so let's do a live demo here. The scenario is I'm going to launch the DNS rebinding attack against my girlfriend in California. So I'll try to gain access to our apartment's Wi-Fi router and do something about it. Let's see. Okay. I'll send this malicious link to her. And I actually have a console for it. So you can see here in the console, once she has clicked into it, she will issue lots of DNS queries to the malicious DNS server that I wrote. It actually would take some seconds to launch this attack. But once we go back, we can see a victim has already connected. And we will try to access the IP address. So we'll try to access DNS rebinding info, but at this time we can gain access to her Wi-Fi router in the apartment. Let's try. Okay, here we are. So the Wi-Fi router's control panel, which is sensitive to anyone outside of the apartment, is now public, and you can actually see the SSID and the password of it. Yes. which is not good. I'll probably change the password later. So the title of this attack is called Interactive DNS Attack, means you can actually interact with the web page. You can see we have remote management, and we can turn on or turn off. Or turn off in case someone tries to attack you. Okay, so cool. Here is a demo. Let's go back. Okay, and we can have more examples of DNS rebounding attacks that I've done before, but I'm not going to demo them here. One of them is to bypass the authentication of Facebook Swag Store so that you can buy the swags from Facebook without being a Facebook employee. And we actually did this on a class that we set up a fake wiki page, and we can actually try to modify the wiki page, even if it is behind the firewall. And this one is dangerous. We can try to access the code review system behind the firewall of a company that I did this demo in my company. So any attacker from outside of the firewall can gain access to the code that our company wrote. So defenses, I would propose two defenses. The first one is well known for DNS rebounding attack, which enforce the header field checking for the host field. So if the request comes from attack.com, the server can actually check the host field to see if it is a malicious request or it is a normal request. And for the browser side, we can also give the DNS entries different priorities so that when the browser tries to kick out the DNS entries, it will kick out the less important ones. Okay, discussion. As we have seen in this presentation, we have a problem in the first hand for cloud-side reference, and people try to patch it with same origin policy. But same origin policy has its own problems, and people try to patch it again with some exceptions. And now, as we can see, the attacker actually leverages the exceptions to do the cloud-side reference again. So we are actually going back to the beginning of a loop after a long travel. It's kind of a lesson that we could learn from this kind of attack and defense, that we are doing all the patches instead of changing the architecture of the HTTP. I don't know. That's it. So any questions? And thanks, everyone.
Hi. John Overhead from Sasan. Test. Good. All right. I had a question about the 1,024 entries. Is that a static limit set by the browser?
The question is the number of DNS entries provided by browser. So in the beginning of this research, it was back in the beginning of 2013, the DNS entries of Chrome is basically 100 entries, so we can easily flood that. But later on, the Chrome community increased the number of DNS entries to 1,000. But as we can see, we only need like 20 seconds, even if it is 1,000 entries.
So do you think that as that cat and mouse progresses, like if I 1,000x the number of entries that the browser can resolve, can the attacker 1,000x the parallelism of those requests? Like, can you speed up the actual attack to maintain its practicality?
Yeah, I thought about that. I think the attack speed is limited by the maximum session number provided by browser. In Chrome, I think it is like 6, so I don't know if there's a good way to improve the speed. I tried to use FTP protocol instead of HTTP, but FTP is not supported in the same origin policy, in the cross-site reference. Thank you.
Hi, Rick Farrow. Such as something I didn't really understand about this. So when you're flushing the cache and you're giving it all these bogus entries, why not have those bogus entries coming from, say, an iframe and then returning the localhost address in part of that iframe, so now you can use that to do your relay attack. Why doesn't that work?
Sorry, I don't quite understand.
Well, okay, so you want to flush the cache so you can do rebinding.
Yes.
But while you're flushing the cache, you're giving it a new set of mappings between a name and an address.
Yes.
So why can't you use that name for and bind that to 120 to the localhost address and use that?
And I think if you try to rebind, so the question is, can I rebind the IP address in a first hand to attack.com?
Yeah, I know that's what you did, but I was wondering if you could say, you know, n1.rebindinfo and make that 127.0.0.1.
Yeah, but
use that within an iframe. Would that work?
I see. So, but I think even with iframe, you have still need to confirm the same on your policy. So if you have an iframe to google.com, you cannot access the data from the iframe. Although the iframe can be displayed on the browser to the user, but any JavaScript in the parent frame cannot access the children iframe.
Yeah, you essentially run into the same problem again. Okay,
yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Antoine Deligna from INRIA Paris. I have some comments about your presentation. So thank you for bringing up DNS rebinding, because as you said, it's not a fixed issue. And in fact, I want to point out that you don't even need a DNS cache flushing to make it work due to some other problems with the same origin policy. So as you may know, you can actually weaken same origin policy by setting a value to your document.origin. And if it's a value that is higher in the DNS hierarchy, this allows communication with between frames. So in fact, if you use an iframe and have the target for your attack on your top-level domain and your self-control web server on a subdomain, you can in fact escalate access to the parent frame, which points to the victim's web server, by setting document.origin and allow cross-origin access to the victim's frame.
So you are saying we can basically disconnect the iframe from the parent frame.
So. So if you have attacker.x.com and x.com, you can point x.com to Google service and attacker.x.com to the attacker web server and use document.origin equal x.com on the attacker web server, which will give you access and complete frame access to the Google service frame. So in fact, you don't even need DNS flushing to do the attack. And the other really solid solution is to only allow name-based server to answer and not IP-based.
Yeah, I think that's a good approach. Thanks.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.